for coming. This talk is about healing healthcare with the belief that our healthcare system is very sick. We may have some of the best medical care available in the world in terms of our medical professionals, in terms of our medical knowledge, our medical research, our medical technology, our medical institutions, many of the best in the world, but very dysfunctional system of access. And as a matter of fact, I think we would have a challenge to call it a system because it's thousands of different ways people access it or don't access it. And I'm John Marty, been in the village for most of a week, we'll be here one more week, and state senator for 32 years. I think of myself as a new one, but I guess I'm not anymore. I'm second in seniority in our Minnesota Senate. And been working on the idea of universal health care for quite some time with the belief that we can and must do better, premise being our health care system is sick. The Affordable Care Act helped cover more people, but it didn't fundamentally change any of the things we're doing with it. It made a convoluted, confused system more confused, but in the process ended up covering about half of the population of the country that was uninsured in the past now has insurance. Though, as I'll mention later, that insurance is not healthcare to me. It's not even access to healthcare. If I have rotten teeth and I now have healthcare coverage and my healthcare coverage doesn't cover dental, am I covered? Well, I'm covered for some things, but it really doesn't meet my needs. Anyway, the system, we can and must help heal our healthcare system. Two months ago, Minneapolis Star Tribune had a newspaper story about a 26-year-old named Alex Smith who aged out of his parents' health plan at age 26, discovered he couldn't afford coverage of his own. Within weeks, he was trying to ration his diabetes medication because he couldn't afford $1,300 refill. A month later, a young restaurant manager was dead. Autopsy found he suffered a critical shortage of insulin, a hormone that regulates blood sugar and energy in the body. This article, it said last May, this was written in May, it was a year earlier he died. I didn't hear about it. I'm sure his family knew about it, but nobody else did. It's a relatively routine thing that happens. The only reason this made the headline and made the newspaper story a year later, was because his mother was speaking out, saying this isn't okay. She lost her son, she wants to fix it. She's angry at pharma, who's overcharging for insulin. She's angry at the system for the way it deals with people. And there are estimates of about 25,000 Americans every year who die in similar circumstances, lack of healthcare. So it's not newsworthy. This was newsworthy because the mom decided she was taking up some cause because of it. We can and must heal our healthcare system. When we talk in politics, a lot of things, it's all important, but somehow in state capitals, in Washington, D.C., and so on, we don't treat these things with the urgency that we might feel. If you're this young man's mother, you might see this as a little more urgent than we seem to treat these things in politics. Well, next year we hope to do this, or the following year we hope to make progress on that. Common sense universal healthcare system is what I'd like to see us do. I'll get into what I think is common sense, and universal, I think, should speak for itself, covering everyone for all their medical needs. I'd argue, and there's some who would disagree, that it's something that's so important in such a tough fight. You ought to fight wherever you can fight it, push it at both federal and state level. At a conference in Minneapolis a month ago, or less than a month ago, a woman from Washington State who's organizing. I saw lots of people from Oregon there who were interested in similar things. In Minnesota, we proposed the Minnesota Health Plan. We call it just a simple name that summarizes what it is. It would be a health plan for Minnesota and all Minnesotans. Be the first in the nation. I don't care if we're first or if somebody else is. The point is, I hope it happens soon. And that 26-year-old's mom would have wished it happened a year or two earlier. What's our problem? I argue we're largely tinkering with a broken system. Affordable Care Act was huge tinkering, lots of little changes to try and plug patches and a leaky dam. You plug a patch here, and oops, another leak springs up there, and you try and patch it. That's roughly what we've done. How have we done so? Well, we've always figured out one of the things for 40 years in healthcare politics. Healthcare is too expensive. That's why people don't get covered. We got to do something about it. And when something's too expensive, the solution is don't use as much of it, make it more difficult to get. So we've tried that for about 40 years. We limit networks. You go to most countries, you go to the doctor, which doctor? Well, you decide who's close to home, who's convenient, who can serve you better. Here we use networks. You can go to these hospitals, these doctors. Copays and deductibles, that really works. You know, you charge enough. Maybe if you're a gazillionaire, $1,000 copay is nothing, but for a lot of people, for a Medicaid population, a $3 copay for a prescription may be too much. If you're mentally ill and you need a $3 copay for mental health drugs to keep you rational and so on, and you're hungry, your most pressing need is going to be your stomach, you're going to spend $3 on food rather than medication. So copays and deductibles definitely help people not use as much health care. We restrict coverage to more and more things. We've always restricted things like dental being separate, long-term care being separate, chemical dependency treatment is separate. And we use a new one in more recent years, more and more frequently, prior authorization. Your medical provider gets permission to do a treatment. This is going off the rails in some ways of that diabetics need to get, for many insulin products, they need to get a prior authorization, in some cases every 6 months. I'm not an expert in any medical things, but I do know diabetics tend to need insulin, and it's not something that changes from month to month. 40 years of reform is making healthcare difficult to get, and it's succeeded. We use healthcare less often than other countries, but we spend twice as much as them. And we have worse health outcomes. We do visit the doctor less. These are just some boring charts to show it. This is doctor visits per person, several-year-old chart, but it's the numbers are all the same every year. You check the newer ones. United States, the red line there is about 4 visits per cap per person per year. Some of these countries, Japan and Korea, for whatever reason, they go 3 times as much or more. But that's not necessarily an indication of good or bad health care, but it's suggesting we're not, Americans aren't running the doctor for every little trivial thing. Our health outcomes lag far behind. This is life expectancy. This was 2014 for everyone but Canada, and it's, we're just under 79 years. We do much better than Mexico, which is 74 or something, and Latvia and Hungary and Slovak Republic, but we're not doing as well as most other industrialized nations are. On the other end, infant mortality, where you want lower numbers, obviously. Iceland has about a sixth as many of us, and again, we beat Mexico out. But we're not doing that well. I think World Health Organization has done some rankings. We were like 37th best. And that's a lot of countries ahead of us when you think of what some of those countries are. You picture we might be doing better. Yeah, we spend twice as much. This chart, again, they're always several years behind the numbers you can get. But we're actually over 10,000 per person now. But this year it was 8,400. And if you draw a halfway line of 4,200, you can see all but about 7 or 8 of these countries. There are 2 or 3 others not on this chart that might be over half. But basically, the rest of the world spends less than half than we do on healthcare. That should raise 2 questions. One is, what kind of society tries to make it difficult? Because those are measures to make it difficult for people to get healthcare. What kind of society tries to make it difficult for your own people to get healthcare? In a practical question, if it's not saving money, shouldn't we try a new approach? A new model, I'd like the one, police and fire protection. It's a public need, we all need some of it, but nobody has to apply for new coverage each year. Open enrollment in Minnesota for most of our plans is late October, early November, and so on. You don't have to apply for police and fire coverage. You don't have to pay a deductible before a fire department comes. You don't have to ask if they'll accept your plan. If we take care of it, people, universal police and fire coverage in the U.S., elementary education, elementary and secondary education, if it's a it's something everybody needs, and some people have much more expensive needs, especially with education. Some have much more expensive needs than others, but shouldn't we do the same with health and dental care? So how do you, this Minnesota Health Plan is something that we're proud of in Minnesota, but it's basically something I would hope is a model. Before you design a healthcare system, you map up your direction, same as when you plan a trip, you decide where you're going first. Spell out directions. These principles are ones, I'm going to go through them quickly, but cover everyone, that's what I mean by universal. Cover all medical needs. Why you have to say, I've never figured out the idea that your teeth are less important than your toes.
Yeah.
They both matter. And your actually heart disease and other things are more likely to spring from tooth infection than something going wrong with your toes, broken toe or something. Let patients choose their doctors and hospitals. In other words, no network. Let people choose who they want to use and have those doctors and patients and their doctors make the medical decisions, not some third party, an insurance company, an employer, or government. Would want to require reducing costs, not by denying care. There are plenty of other ways to do it. Make it affordable to all. In our case, the premiums would be based on income rather than age or health condition. Focus on preventive care to improve health as one of the weakest current system. Everybody has their own little patchwork things, health plans. Oh yeah, we'll give you a rebate if you join a health club or something. But in terms of embracing public health, we don't do a good job of it. We have the Minnesota Grant Program, Safe Health Improvement Grant Program. We give grants to cities who have innovative ways to try and reduce obesity or reduce smoking or things like that. But it should be embedded in the whole healthcare system. We may spend maybe a tenth of a percent of our healthcare dollar on preventive health. Maybe we should be spending a lot more than that, actually. Make sure there are enough providers to avoid waiting lines. It doesn't do you any good if you can't get into the doctor because there are too long waiting lines. We want to maintain leadership in medical care research technology. We want to pay providers in a fair and timely manner. That doesn't matter to any of us unless you're a provider. And so it does matter to all of us, because if you can't logically get people paid and so on, they're not going to want to participate. A simple, understandable funding and payment system, what we have now, those estimate of benefit things you get in the mail, and I always kind of wonder, well, why'd you send it to me if this is not a bill? But that's the way we work. Anyway, I think all those principles are important. We didn't have any other proposals. I actually offered a legislation requiring the health commissioner in 2003 or so, under a Republican administration, I'm a Democrat, offering them to asking the Commissioner of Health to design a healthcare system that met the principles. And, you know, I don't care what they come up with. If it meets those principles, I'll sign on board. May not be ideal, but I can't picture, it's got to be a whole lot better than we're doing now. So we designed a plan that does, we call it Minnesota Health Plan. What is it? It's governed by those principles. We legally bound to them. Focus on well-being and public health, not profits. Medical decisions left to patient doctor. How does it work? Real simply, the same providers you have now, and maybe a few new ones. We might be having more public health nurses, such as in schools, where not every school has nurses anymore. Clinics, hospitals, be the existing ones. You go to the same place. Everyone's covered a simple application form. In our legislation, we actually require that it be less than 2 pages long, which wouldn't need to be that long, but take the right page. I don't care. Your card would be good everywhere, no networks, no copays, no deductibles. Copays and deductibles, as I mentioned earlier, are a very inefficient way to determine who needs what care. Full coverage when you're traveling out of state. No copays and deductibles, as I mentioned, all medical needs are covered. Families would pay premiums, again, based on ability to pay. And they'd be paid to the Minnesota Health Plan, not to Blue Cross or to Aetna or whoever you pay premiums to, you'd be switching who you pay it to. Let's see, employers would no longer have to shop around. I mean, even small employers have to devote a significant amount of time to, usually annually, some get 2-year contracts, annually renegotiating their health plan. And you know, if you've got a small employer and somebody gets cancer, you could be cooked. But you shop around, and then you have to, at the state. I mean, the state's a fairly big employer, and they have a lot of people up there telling their employees what the new plans are, what it means, and what kind of deductibles you're paying and how you can avoid this and so on. Employers would be no longer having to do any of that. They'd be replaced with a dedicated tax. They'd be paying a tax in lieu of their obligation to take care of people under Affordable Care Act. The health plan would negotiate rates and compensation. That'd be governed by a democratically selected board. We actually spell out a few little details in the legislation, such as that the CEO of the enterprise would be compensated at the level of top state commissioners, which is well under $200,000. Even Minnesota, all of our health plans until last year were nonprofit. They were legally required to be nonprofit. But when they're paying $3-4 million to the CEO of a nonprofit, it takes a different kind of meaning. I think, logically speaking, you want the administrative system not to be a big, huge enterprise. You want it to be lean and efficient. You're going to be paying a lot of medical professionals, not more than the health plan administrators, but the medical professionals are the ones who deliver the health care. The health plan simply administers the plan. Board would administer the health system bound by those principles. They negotiate prices, are required to end conflicts of interest, which there are many of in our medical industrial complex system. You could describe it as Medicare for all, covers everyone over and under 65, but it would also be like Medicare Plus because it would cover all these other things, dental, long-term care, which a lot of people as they approach 65 are surprised that Medicare does not cover long-term care.
Yep.
Plus no more co-pays or deductibles. Is it government health care? When we introduced the bill last year after we lost the majority and after Trump's election introduced the bill and decided we weren't going to do anything, just introduce it that year because it wasn't going anywhere. But we had a news conference and I guessed the first question was going to be, don't we want less government health care? And I said, yeah, I want a lot less government health care, and you should read the bill, because this does not give the government, or you could call this a quasi-government or a nonprofit or whatever, but it is a public entity that delivers the health care. It would be separated from the government, and the legislature, governor, others have no control over it. You don't have people saying, well, we'll cover you for this, but not for this. In effect, it's patient and provider-based system, which we can get into a little bit later about, oh, aren't people all going to overuse health care then? We can't afford to do what we're doing now, so how are we going to cover more people for all their medical needs? And I would argue it, despite sounding counterintuitive, it's the reality. Both economic analysis of plans like this in the U.S. and empirical evidence from around the world shows that it's less expensive than what we're doing now to cover everyone through a logical single-payer plan. I used the word single payer for the first time here, and I'll explain what that is here. System where doctors and hospitals are paid by one payer, not multiple ones, insurance companies. That's the way Medicare was. It's originally, now it's multiple payers in Medicare Advantage and so on. But paid by one payer, hence the term single payer. But it's not a very descriptive term. People don't have a clue what you're talking about, or if they do, they know they love it or hate it, but they're not sure what it is. I argue it's the only way you could get universal health care in the United States. There are some countries that have multiple payers. Germany, Switzerland do. They tend to be much more expensive than other countries, but they do basically cover everyone. The difference there, why we couldn't do that here, is in those countries, like in Germany. I went on a healthcare exchange thing to Germany with a number of other people, and one of the people in my group was the CEO of Blue Cross Minnesota at the time, and he was telling these German health plans, you guys need the ability to, you need more options. You're not allowed to negotiate on who you cover. You got to take whoever comes. You're not able to negotiate on what you cover because it's all spelled out. You're not able to limit who the networks you use, because you got to lose any willing provider. You're not, what you pay those providers, it's all determined ahead. You guys need the ability to negotiate and do those things. And I was going to say, yeah, because otherwise it's, they're patently obvious that it's not a, they're not adding anything to the system. They're not negotiating anything. The difference is in those countries, the government says, you're going to do this, you're going to do it this way, and this way, and this way, and this way, and spell it all out. So they have to cover everyone, and they have to do all that. In our country, it's more like the insurance companies tell the government, we'll do this, and you can't do this, and we won't do that. And Affordable Care Act's a good illustration of that. You look at insurance company profits in the last few years, you can see they've been very pleased with the Affordable Care Act in some ways. And of course, like in Minnesota, the individual market, which about in Minnesota is less than 5% of the population, buys through the exchange and so on, they buy insurance on their own. And insurance companies hugely saying they were losing money on it. Everywhere else in the system, they're doing very fine, however. And so I'd argue the only way we're going to get universal health care is to replace it with a single system. When I say how this is an illustration, it's a 10-year-old illustration, but it was powerful enough. I made this chart. I don't know if any of you are from Colorado, but in 2007, Colorado had a request for proposals that they issued to the public. And who's got a better idea on how we can deliver healthcare? Not how can we tweak this or tweak that, but how would you deliver healthcare if you could find a better way to do it? They had 24 proposals. This was to the broader public. 24 groups came in. They whittled it down to the best four. And then they hired the Lewin Group, which is a health economics consulting firm, to do the analysis. And I made this chart out of it. They had a 250-some page report, link at the bottom. If somebody wants to dig it out, I can give you the link. But I just, one or two summary sentences thing of the plans. The only one I'll point out is the bottom one was a proposed universal health care system. And I made a chart of the two things they were saying their problems were. We got a lot of people aren't covered, a lot of people don't have access to health care, and two, it's too expensive. Their goal was to end those problems. And they started with about 800,000 uninsured. The first plan cut it almost by half, way down, further down, and the universal one didn't take all six digits there. It was easy. It covered everyone. The increase in health spending, they were not trying to do this, but they wanted to hold it to a minimum if they could. $600 million, $1.3 billion. The single one was the most highest price tag of all, but it had a minus sign in front of it. It saved money, which was their goal. They wanted to save money and they wanted to cover people. So, and incidentally, that the reason I mentioned that this was the analysis, this 250-page report was done by the Lewin Group, is because their parent company is United Health Group of Minnetonka, Minnesota, the largest health insurer in the country, which is only to say that, not that they do good work or bad work or anything like that, but just to say they are not biased in favor of a single system like that because it would put their parent company out of business. So, you know, I just say that that's not a bias there. Anyhow, when you look at these numbers, you can conclude in Colorado that only one plan covered everyone, only one plan saved money. In effect, only one plan worked. However, they decided single payer isn't feasible, so instead of fighting for something that works, let's pick something that doesn't work and we'll fight for that instead. That's not the way people would frame it, though. That's the way in politics we're better at marketing than that. The way to market this is to say, if it's not feasible, we'll find something that's feasible and we'll fight for that instead. This says the same thing, it just says it a little more bluntly, perhaps. I'd argue that's what came up with the Affordable Care Act, and part of the way reason I say that is because in 2003, Barack Obama, who was then a state legislator, told the group, you can view it online, said the only way we're going to, the way we have to fix the system is we need a, what they call a single payer system. He says we definitely need that, but we're not going to get it right now, he said, because we need three things we don't have. Those three things were a Democratic U.S. House of Representatives, a Democratic U.S. Senate, and a Democrat in the White House. And 5 years later, he was that Democrat in the White House, and he had those other two things. And I agree with him, it probably wasn't feasible at that time, but that's when you fight to make something feasible instead of decide you're going to settle for something that you would acknowledge doesn't work. Now, I told you that it's cheaper, and the obvious thing is, of course, how can it be cheaper? Yeah, you say there's evidence that shows that, but why? Why would it be cheaper? I'd argue there are two reasons. One is logical pricing, and the other one is by cutting bureaucracy. Logical pricing, you negotiate fair prices. The current problem, two-pack of EpiPens was $100 in 2006, now over $600. That's the same product. pharmaceutical companies do slightly tweak things so they can extend their patents on them. But EpiPens, these are old drugs. In 15, 20 years ago, whenever they were invented, it was a new delivery system, a self-delivery system, which is a great idea and so on. These next two numbers here, in 1 year, I think it's 3-4 years ago, 60 prescription drugs doubled in cost in 1 year. 20 of those were quadrupling of cost. That's not because, oh, we had more research to do. That's simply just we can get away with it. Other countries negotiate prescription drug prices. Medicare Part D, when it came into being, we basically, the U.S. government told pharmaceutical industry, we're going to buy whatever our seniors need for prescription drugs, but we are going to prohibit Congress. Congress prohibited the government from negotiating prices on. So we're going to buy anything our folks need and just tell us how much to pay. And which,
yeah. What about the VA?
VA is separate. VA is different, and Medicaid is allowed to negotiate. But Medicare Part D, they explicitly wrote into law you can't negotiate prices. Within a week after the bill passed, the member of Congress who was chair of the committee and who authored the bill became the CEO, resigned to become the CEO of Pharma at over $1 million a year salary for an executive. Anyhow, negotiating prices can make a difference, as I think we all know. Hospital pricing. Simple knee replacement. This is a Yale study about 2 years ago, 3 years ago now. It says simple knee replacement range from $3,400 to $55,800. 16-to-1 price disparity. Minnesota, the health commissioner of health, did a study earlier this year on the same basic knee replacement thing, and it ranged in Minnesota from $4,500 to like $40,000 or so. So ours is only an 8-to-1 price disparity, but then again, this is a big nation, and 16-to-1 price disparity. You'll find 3, 4, 5-to-1 price disparity, 8-to-1 price disparity in one city. And other countries negotiate medical prices. Just to keep it in perspective, try and buy a new car at a dealer and go shop around at other dealers for the identical car. You might, if you're really a good shopper, you might save $500 or $1,000. You might save 5, 10% maybe. 1,600%, don't bet on it. The other thing is with these hospitals, you know, the one charging $3,400, they're not losing money doing it. That's what they decide to charge. And frankly, they're going to be able to get away with charging more if they want, but they think that's a fair price. They're making money doing that. I'm sure the one making $55,000 is making money too. Probably a lot more money. But if you negotiate money, maybe you're not paying those high prices. Cutting bureaucracy. Eliminate insurance and billing bureaucracy. And to illustrate this, I like to use an analogy. I'm sorry about the really cheap clip art, but that's if schools were funded like hospitals, teachers would spend time every day to figure out how much time they spent, their time allocation thing for each student, how much they spend. And again, with special needs students, it's a lot higher than other kids. So there's huge variation how much time. It's not like a teacher with 23 kids in a classroom is going to divide all the time and everything into 23. Kids take a lot of variation and such. You allocate that. And then down to the school billing office where they allocate all the overhead. Again, in Minnesota, where our schools don't have billing offices, fortunately. But the parents would purchase school insurance plans, which are very expensive, so employers would offer coverage to their employees' kids. And bills would go to the school insurance plan. As charge masters, what anybody who works in medical care at a hospital knows, the charge master is the system they do to calculate the charges for everything. I just tell people who don't work in hospitals, it seems to me to be a pretty random tripling of costs or so of what they might otherwise be. Not rational necessarily, but you got to negotiate prices with all the payers, which means you got to have a higher charge price. Insurance plans negotiate for discounts, and can't afford school insurance, you're stuck with the full listed price, which is sometimes 3, 4, 5 times as much. Many families with school insurance can't afford the co-pays and deductibles, so you're going to need a collections agency to work with the school to help collect things, and you know, some kids can't afford it even if they don't have it through their employer, they can buy through the exchange. They can government would have to subsidize the exchange for people who can't afford that, even so, some aren't gonna be insured. When you say those kids, they don't get an education, well, maybe the school will give them charity care and just cover them uncompensated care for those kids, because we want every kid to get an education. Will this improve education? Of course not. Where are we gonna spend our time? Not just the administrator and the teacher time, but even the parents spending the time shopping for school plans each year and trying to pay all the bills and everything. That's time that could be spent with their kids, which might be more useful. Students might have to switch schools if the schools are out of network, and every time you switch employers, you're gonna have problems with that. You don't have coverage, well, you don't get an education. Would it save money? Of course not. Think of all that expense. It's this huge expense of a billing in bureaucracy. And if you just think about it, just think how much more, again, the time your employer spends dealing with healthcare stuff, if they had to spend that much on the education system as well. And think about if you had Blue Plus for education and all the other health plans that in the education and so on, how much money they all take out of the system and all the billing back and forth. It's hugely expensive. This is a chart of both the physicians and administrators over a 40-year period. This is a very flat thing. That's the number of physicians, a low growth. Administrators has grown up. It's actually about a tripling of physicians over 40 years, and administrators is more like a 30-fold increase. That might explain some of the bureaucracy that we're spending efforts on. What about a public option? That's another way of, some people have suggested public option. In Minnesota, I use with our education analogy, if you had a Blue Plus for education, we have health partners like Seattle does, different company. But health partners have an education partners. We have a UCARE, which is University of Minnesota Physicians Health Plan. UCARE could have ULEARN and so on. And you could have a public option as well, which might be a better deal for some of the people buying school insurance for their kids. Might give a little bit better coverage, but it doesn't fundamentally change anything. And why would you want to have all those plans, again, getting involved in the school system in the first place? So a public option might be a better option than something else, but it's not, it's a tinkering with what we're doing. What about loss of insurance industry jobs? This is one of the huge questions people would say, and it's not just insurance industry. A lot of people work in hospitals and physicians' offices. A huge number of people are checking boxes and filling out forms, and it's a serious matter. There was one estimate that to do this in Minnesota, it could be as much as 40,000 jobs lost, and that's a huge number of people. To put it in perspective, there are about four times as many people who leave employment of any job in any month, some to retire, some to take new jobs, some because they're fired or laid off, but about four times that many people in 1 month. And so times 12, you can see how much turnover there is in the market. So it's a huge number, and I think we have a moral obligation to address that. And our bill and bills like this at the national level set aside a big chunk of money, a small percentage of healthcare dollar, but usually like 1% or so, to pay for those retraining and relocation costs. And again, a lot of the people are already trained. A lot of nurses are doing box checking, especially LPN nurses and so on. You could be using them to provide the other things they do. But there would be job displacement, and it's not something to ignore. It's a very real concern, and it's one of the reasons it makes it tougher to pass something like this. What about long waiting times? People say, well, Canada's got a single payer system. Oh, they have all these waiting lines, which is greatly exaggerated, and it's also something we've been working at addressing. And there's one group that advocates for this and is advocates for addressing that, and they've asked in their papers why. I mean, they say there's no correlation between our system of healthcare and a shortage of providers. It's a lack of adequate funding to provide enough providers. Other countries with universal healthcare systems don't have waiting lines, and let's not forget we have waiting lines that some people can't even get into. But with our proposal, we have one of the binding legal requirements is that you have to make sure there are enough providers to do it, which may mean paying more for some people. We have a surplus of specialists. We have a shortage of primary care physicians. We have primary shortage of certain types of nurses. We have shortage of psychiatrists. If you need to pay more, or especially in geographic areas, I mean, there are some small towns have trouble getting doctors and so on to practice there because it's you're on call a lot more often, among other things. And so they may have to pay more, but the health plan would be legally bound to address that, because I'd argue long waiting lines are the same thing as denial of care in many cases. One more thing I wanted to get to before we get to the politics of how this all happened. One more big issue, because I mentioned it earlier, is the cost. And I say evidence shows that because of these savings, and so you're actually going to cost less. But the biggest thing people say is, look, if you're not going to have co-pays and deductibles, and if doctors and patients are the ones who make medical decisions, not some prior authorization by an insurance company or somebody, how in the world are you going to stop people from using healthcare, going hog wild, getting everything they can? I've actually heard the analogy used, saying, you know, what if grocery stores were, groceries or food was free? People go to grocery stores and buy the most expensive stuff, waste it like crazy. They buy steak for their dogs. If food were free, well, I'm not sure anybody's saying food should be free or anything like that, but I think what I'd say is healthcare is not the same as that. We all want healthcare. We want more healthcare if we don't have access to healthcare we need. But people are not out there begging for more healthcare. They're not out there begging for more healthcare, and we want as much as we need, and we don't want more. And I've yet to see people say, "Oh, I love going to the doctor."
Yeah.
And I like to use the illustration that you got next. Pay off next week, why don't you get another colonoscopy, because that was so much fun. And the reality is people want more health care if they're not getting the care they need. They want to visit the dentist more if they need more dental care. They don't like to go to the dentist because it's so much fun. It isn't. I knew that one of my colleagues was... Thank you. One of my colleagues, staff, sent my office a thing saying how their boss was so dedicated, she was getting dental work done, and she was texting while getting dental work done. So next time I went in for a dentist, I asked if the dentist they could pause, or I could take a picture of myself with my mouth wide texting then. And so I could say, yeah, some of us do that sort of thing, but no, we don't like visiting a dentist. How did we get into the mess we're in? This is a picture of a guy named Max Baucus. He was a U.S. Senator from Montana. He was Obama credited him with the bill signing for the Affordable Care Act. He was the one, he said, he's the guy who designed the bill. He's the one who wrote it. He deserves the most credit. A year earlier when he was saying, well, we're going to consider everything. Well, not the single payer. Why not? It's not on the table. It cannot pass. He repeatedly said this, and he refused to consider any discussion of it. And that meant it wasn't on the table in 2009 even. Why doesn't it pass? Well, politicians receive a lot of money from medical industrial complex. Max Baucus was at the time one of the leading recipients of it. And he got $750,000 in the few years before the Affordable Care Act. As a matter of fact, that shows up in many ways. His staff, when he was called out at the news conference for the signing of the Affordable Care Act, and he was called out as the author, he pointed out some woman who was his healthcare staff lead, who was she? Well, she was a former vice president at WellPoint, or one of the large insurance companies. She had come from being a vice president insurance company to be the one he credited with writing the ACA. Those contributions make a difference. Politicians are afraid it's controversial, they might lose re-election, and I'll get to that a little more in just a second. But this cartoon, I found this last year, and it was sort of, it was Democratic politicians' stance on gay marriage. Approval was climbing, and they're watching the polls. All of a sudden, it hits some magic number, and they all can't be in favor of it enough. Always been in favor of it, whatever. They race for it. And I'd argue that that happens with a lot of issues, and with this issue, the polls already say overall Americans, generally polls have said roughly 57-59% of Americans favor this. Again, if you say positive things about it, it goes up. You say negative things about it, it goes down. Interestingly, Republican Party, this one poll in about early 2016, said of Republicans, about 18-20% wanted to keep the Affordable Care Act. It's not surprising, most of them hated it. About 40% thought we should switch to a single plan funded like this. So it could happen, I think it will happen, I'd argue we don't have much choice but for it to happen. But the times are changing. Senator Max Baucus now supports single payer. He told Montana newspapers that last fall, I think it was, which is very nice to hear, but it would have helped a lot more. He's no longer in the Senate, perhaps he's retired. It would help if he was in the Senate where he could actually do something about it, but he doesn't now. Medicare for All has 17 Senate co-sponsors, one of which was a Minnesota senator, Al Franken, who I was going to talk with him afterwards, but he resigned from office before I had a chance to talk with him. But he was one of those co-sponsors, and the thing I'd say about it is when I say politicians are scared of it, he was scared of it. You can tell because of the raging enthusiasm he said about it when he signed on. News conference, he said, well, you know, Paul Wellstone, who was a hero of his, Paul Wellstone supported it. In fact, Paul Wellstone was the last one to offer such legislation in the U.S. Senate. Paul Wellstone supported it, so I guess it's one of the things we ought to consider. It's not raging enthusiasm. It's kind of, well, you know, if we have to, we'll consider it. Well, why? And I'm just going to psychoanalyze somebody who's not even in office anymore, and it's my analysis. It may not be what's actually going on in his mind. But why would you sign on to it if you're not enthused or you're scared of it? Well, because saying, hey, we're for more of what we got doesn't work very well. It does work to say we'd rather have this than to repeal and not replace with anything. But, you know, saying, hey, I love the Affordable Care, let's keep going, let's keep doing this, is wonderful. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons the election went the way it did. In Minnesota, Donald Trump almost won Minnesota, first Republican presidential candidate to almost win Minnesota in many years. And I'd argue in many cases there are people who are paying more for their health care than for their mortgage, more than for their rent, whatever, and they're scared. And they see rates going up. And they see them going up more and more and more, and they cover less things, and they're scared about it. And they're required to have it now. And you have one presidential candidate saying, hey, the Affordable Care Act's a good thing. We're going to keep improving it. And that's fear to them because they're doesn't help them, and they can't afford it, and they're stuck with it. And the other candidate says, we're going to throw it out and do something better. You can understand why elections go the way they do. But so they sign on. Al Franken signed on to the bill because, well, what else is there to try now? And I'd argue that it's not really going far out on a political limb. It's not a dangerous position to take. Why? And again, I go through this pseudo conversation with him. Why are you scared? Well, you know what they'll call me? They'll call me a socialist if I sign on to this.
Right.
To which my response is, what did they call you when you co-authored the Affordable Care Act? A socialist. You're a Democrat. They want to call you names, and that's a good name to call you because people are scared of it. So they're not going to attack you with anything new. They're going to attack you with the same thing they've been attacking with. And well, maybe they feel more fiercely that this is a bad thing, and there are lots of powerful interests that would say this is a bad thing. So, but they throw everything at you they can. If they have $10 million to spend it to attack you, they'll spend 10. If they have 20, they'll spend 20. They'll do whatever they can. So the risk on the negative side, people who don't like it, is there, but it's not worse than what you got now. And on the other hand, you go out there, and I can guarantee you, if he'd give a speech and say, you know, I think one of the things you ought to consider is a universal health care thing like this, Medicare for All, whatever they're calling it. I think you should do that. You know what? You get applause. Some people say, about time somebody's talking about that, because a lot of people like the idea. And politicians, when they hear people applauding and that sort of thing, kind of like that. And so the next speech they give, they use it earlier, and they say it a little more strongly, and they get more applause. And you can't guarantee this, but I care to bet that you have a better chance of winning doing that, no guarantee. I will say that the most popular politician in the country right now still is Bernie Sanders by about 7 or 8 points over anybody else, and partly I'd argue because he does these risky things that everybody hates, that maybe not everybody hates. But so times may be changing. No guarantee of that, but so what? I wrote a book about this. There are a handful of copies in the bookstore, but you can download it free if you want to read it on a Kindle or an ebook or just a PDF. MinnesotaHealthPlan.org. Anyway, I'd be happy to discuss this. You can challenge things or whatever, but welcome discussions.
Are states big enough to enact single payer on their own?
Good question. I would argue yes. A smaller state would have more trouble than a bigger state. Bigger states, California is its own economy. I mean, some states like that are huge in terms of, it's bigger than most countries. A country like Norway has fewer people than Minnesota have. They do it fine. It would be helpful. I'd prefer it to be done at the national level. I think it can be done at a state level, though it would require a lot of federal permission. So we not only have to pass the bill, we then have to get federal waivers to implement it, and a lot of federal waivers. I'm not trying to dismiss it. My pitch when people say it's tough to do is that maintaining what we've got is equally impossible. We can't maintain what we're doing. But yeah, states would be big enough, and some would say, well, it would be better at a bigger size level. But my pitch is it's difficult enough. You try it wherever you can get it. Canada, when they did it in the early 60s, Tommy Douglas in Saskatchewan got through single planning like this, and within a decade, the whole country had it. I care to think that's a reasonable prospect here. But
like Massachusetts did it by on their own. And
they basically did the Affordable Care Act. Matter of fact, Tim Pawlenty, former Minnesota governor, is now running for governor again. He was running for president in 2008, and he, no, 2012, he was running for president, and he was running against a guy named Mitt Romney, and he. His best line in the campaign was he supports Obamacare, because Affordable Care Act was modeled on the same model that Massachusetts had. In other words, it was described as universal health care, though it really wasn't. It was not going to cover everyone. It would cover more people. It would plug in some of the gaps. And Affordable Care, Massachusetts did that. But it won't. It's the same problem. The issue here is it's a big switch to do this. It's not something you can do, okay, we'll do a little bit more. I mean, Minnesota, we have about five big insurers in the state or so. You're not going to, okay, we'll drive two of them out of the market, then we're three payers, drive two more out, then we're a single payer. You're not going to do it that way. It doesn't work that way. And you got to make a bold change in it. And so it does require a switch. It's not a huge change for people. It's about the same impact for any of us. The year you turn 65, you switch to Medicare. And that's a change. You can still go to the same doctors, hospitals, and so on, and it's the payment, what's covered and what's not, is still lots of gaps in it, but it's the same sort of thing. So it's a doable thing, but Massachusetts, nobody in this country has actually tried this yet.
And as far as the Minnesota plan is concerned, will participation on the part of clinics and hospitals be a matter of their own choice?
Own choice, but if they don't, you would not be able to sell insurance outside of the plan. If you want to take private pay patients, which some doctors are doing now because they're so fed up with all the paperwork and stuff, they say we'll provide this care, but we're not going to take insurance. In effect, most would be taking it.
Providing medical insurance in the state of Minnesota would become illegal, basically.
Yeah, you would not be providing it, so it would be only through this. People say, oh, well, if doctors are going to get their pay cut. Some doctors may get their pay cut. If you cut the pay too much, you don't have enough providers, and one of the legal requirements in the plan is to do that. The negotiation thing in countries that have a negotiation works pretty fairly. And every doctor and clinic, the first thing they get is huge administrative savings. You ask doctors how much time they spend on paperwork, you can see why there's a lot of burnout.
That was my question on that chart that showed the growth of the
administrators, yeah,
versus the growth of the medical, the actual providers.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to put on that chart what percent of the providers actually, how's the trend of how much time they have to actually treat patients versus filling out all the paperwork for the bureaucrats?
Well, we had a healthcare task that we've had about 30, in the last three decades, we've had at least 13 Minnesota healthcare task forces, government ones, either appointed by governors or legislatures. The last one we had, I served on a panel with a physician who runs his own business in the East Metro area, and their business was going to people and providing medical care to people in assisted living facilities. And he said, in the last year, a very successful guy, last year we hired 18 new LPNs, a lower level training nurse. We hired 18 of them, because I had said how, you know, this new, more complicated stuff is not mean we're hiring, it's not hiring more doctors and nurses and medical providers, it's hiring more bookkeepers and accountants. And he said, no, that's not true. We've hired 18 new LPNs in the last year. Of course, they are just checking boxes and filling out forms. Notice they're not doing medical work, but yeah, it's a huge incidence of that.
Well, I just, for me, it sounds like the challenge is really around the lobbyists and how much money the politicians get. Yeah, so right. That's one question I have. And also the insurance company. Because it feels like, wouldn't you say that that's like the main challenge right now? It's like
politically, that's the main challenge, yeah.
Well, and that's...
That's the issue.
Change, right? In order to make it
exactly. Better. Exactly.
So how do we do that?
Okay. First thing I'll say, because the number one thing you get when you propose something like this is it's not going to happen. And what was it? Common Wheel magazine, the Catholic Journal, had some columnist write something about how Democrats should be careful in pushing single payer, they shouldn't promise more than they could deliver, and he said they should. The title was Slow Down on Single Payer. And I wrote a response to it saying, hey, we've been waiting 100 years for that. I mean, this was New Deal, one of the things left out of it, and aggressively being sought over the years for 70, 80 years now. And how long do we have to wait? And yeah, so it's not an easy thing. If it was an easy thing, it would have happened by now. But the biggest obstacle, I would argue, in Minnesota, I've got 2/3 of the legislators in my party who are signed on as co-authors. The biggest obstacle is not the other party, it's a big obstacle, but the biggest one is people in my own party, including some who signed on, who, as soon as they get lobbied on it, are kind of, well, okay. Well, we just said we put it out there as an idea. We didn't really mean we really wanted it. We just thought it's something we ought to consider. And that's a huge thing. The biggest obstacle to a lot of this change is our impact of money in politics. It's absolutely a huge one. And so I'm not trying to, I mean, I'm talking about how this might happen. The one pitch I make to those colleagues who say, well, I don't want to spend time on it, or I can't support it, it's not going to happen, you're wasting your time. Those who know political feasibility, the two questions I've been asking them in recent months are, if you're an expert in that, did you know in 2015, did you predict that Donald Trump would be our next president? I don't think there were a lot of people, not a lot of politicians. It was kind of, in either party, I think it was pretty close to 0% who thought that was possible. Or gay marriage, 5 years before it happened, how many thought that was going to become the law of the land so quickly? Taking down Confederate flags in state capitals, how many thought that was going to happen in their lifetime? Things happen sometimes very quickly, and the biggest response I can give to the fact that it's very, very difficult, and what we're doing now is sustainable. You just look at the trends, because when I showed you the prices and everything, every study of what's happening in healthcare in the country suggests it's going to go up like this. Not like, if inflation's like this, it's going up, healthcare costs are going to go like that. Because we've got an aging baby boomer population, we've got all kinds of new issues that are getting worse very quickly. And so we can't sustain what we're doing. And like, if my party gains control of the legislature next year, one of the big challenges they have is our Minnesota Care, which is our just above Medicaid populations, the working poor people who can't afford to buy through the exchange or other things. Minnesota's had a very good program for that for 25 years, we call Minnesota Care. That was funded by a 2% tax on medical providers. I don't think that's the best way to do it, but some people, that was a brilliant way to do it. But that tax got sunsetted. It's going to expire in another 2 years after 30 years. And trying to get back that passed, that reinstitute that tax, I just picture there are a lot of people who could lose elections over that kind of thing. And they're scared silly of it and everything else. And that's just to maintain what we got. You look at all the healthcare challenges. We can't maintain what we've got. I'd say that people who are offering alternatives, they're not feasible either. And that's not to say, oh, this is going to happen tomorrow. I'm not predicting that. I'm saying I think it has to happen, and we have to find a way to make it happen.
Okay.
But the politics is, as you said, the biggest single
challenge. Yeah, I just think that that's where...
It's huge, yes. Over here.
So when you first brought up it wasn't feasible, I kept thinking, well, what wasn't feasible about it? Because it's going to cover everybody and it's going to be cheaper. What else do you want? But it's the political will, I guess.
Right.
And the political will
does not always happen, and she's pointing out there are lots of people who make a lot of money in the system. And every year we get more and more, and everybody gets a new, the medical industrial complex. The reason this is happening that way, we didn't have pharmacy benefit managers, which PBMs, we didn't have them 30 years ago and so on, and now everybody, I mean, our pharmaceutical pricing thing is so bizarre, and it's so incredibly convoluted, and nothing is honest. We have average wholesale price, which is not an average or a wholesale price. It's nothing like that. It's such a convoluted scheme, and every time somebody starts a new medical business, a medical administrative business, they can almost guarantee they're going to save you money if you hire them. And they're not providing any medical care. They're just sucking more dollars out of the system. There's one new one in Minnesota the last 2 or 3 years where they will work with employers, they will contract with employers, and certain fixed amount of several hundred dollars per employee, they will go over all the employees' medical bills to catch mistakes. And they can guarantee you it will save you more than whatever, $300 or $500 per person. We'll save you more than that money just because they have the computers with the right things to catch which things they can question and challenge, and they'll find that many mistakes per person. That's a great new business. It saves the employer money. It stops people from paying things they shouldn't be paying. But if they're charging $500 per person per employee, they're not providing a penny's worth of medical care yet. That's all the medical spending gets more convoluted. So her point about their people fight hard to keep what they got. So it doesn't matter what makes sense. It matters whether you can fight those things up over here than over there.
John, you said early on that this wasn't a government program. It was going to be funded separately. And my experience in countries that have single payer is that the government's a single payer.
Let me clarify. I didn't say it wasn't going to be funded by government.
Yeah.
It would be funded by Minnesota Health Fund. And whether you call it a quasi-government thing, or you could, I mean, I don't know, it would be independent. The legislature and governor under our governance structure wouldn't be the ones making the decisions. Totally independent. The only appointment the governor gets is for the ombudsman, who has the ability to fight for patients against if the system is mistreating them and so on. But no, it would be funded through a public funding system. It'd be employers have a tax, as a gross receipts or payroll tax. We're open to various things. And then for individuals, it'd be premiums, which would be collected perhaps by the Department of Revenue. They're used to collecting things based on ability of pay, but they're premiums that go to, like, Social Security Trust Fund. They don't go to the state government. They don't go anywhere like that. So what I'm saying is it's not a government-run healthcare system. It's funded through a system collected by that and so on.
Yeah.
But it would not be... No, I'm not trying to say it's not funded by government or administered by it, but the healthcare, all the healthcare decisions, all of that. Right now, government tells you what things they will cover, especially for Medicaid and Medicare. They make the decisions, not patients and their doctors. And it's getting off the rails. Yes?
So you mentioned sustainability in terms of a lot of conversation about cost. How is this plan going to tackle kind of the fee-for-service nature?
Sure.
And kind of, you know, testing more and more diagnostics because you're afraid of medical malpractice. And also you alluded to, you know, joint replacements, and there's Medicare out of the Innovation Center, you know, joint replacement bundles and all that. Yeah. Is that all being incorporated?
Sure. Okay, well, that's a good question, and it's a tangent that's important to talk about, and so I'm glad you raised the question. In healthcare, and I would largely challenge what a lot of healthcare policy people would say, and there's huge disputes in the field, and a majority of people clearly think we've got a huge problem with what we call fee for service, which is I deliver some test or blood test or physical therapy or dental filling or whatever I do, and I'm paid for that. I'm paid a fee for that service. And first of all, I'd say that's the way 99% of our economy is run. We pay price for a product or a fee for a service. That's the way we do things. Holden Village, you pay a fee for being here for a week. You're not paying for each food item, but you're paying for a service, you're paying for a product.
But that's a bundle. That
you're paying, whether by a bundle or individual. And in healthcare, that's decided that that's been extremely bad. Though, like when I asked for evidence from our Department of Human Services when they were running a task force on this, I asked them for evidence on why it's so much more expensive, and they sent the first paper they sent to prove it was one by Bill Frist, who was a U.S. senator from Tennessee, who was also a medical doctor, and he was saying how you know, the problem is that we have fee for service and overuse of care because providers give all the care in the world they can, and patients demand it all and everything else. And the first footnote he uses to prove that, first footnote in his thing, is for a paper that's basically saying the problem isn't overuse of care, it's the pricing. And so I would really challenge that. There's a University of Minnesota health economist who described it very neatly, and I like his way of doing it. He says, in healthcare, there are three main ways we pay for medical care. Fee for service. And he says many ways we pay for healthcare, but the three worst are fee for service, capitation, and salary. What are they? Well, fee for service, the one I just explained. Capitation is where you pay a fixed amount per month, like you pay insurance premium or the health plan or something, and they deliver all the care for that premium. Or salary. Those are the three main ways you pay providers in healthcare. He said those are the three worst ways. Of course, people laugh at that because everything's paid in some combination of those things. And he said, well, you know, there are incentives behind them. Look at the incentives. The incentive in fee for service, which they keep always pointing out, is the incentive is for doctors and providers to provide as many things to as many people as possible. Maybe that's not a good incentive. For capitation or the monthly payment for things, fixed things or whatever, the incentive is to provide as few things, as few services to as many people as possible. You want to treat them as little as you can, which is also not really a good incentive. And salary, the incentive is to do as few things for as few people as possible, which is also not a good one. In other words, if you're looking purely at the economic impact on somebody, that may not be the best way to do it, but that's the way we do our whole economy. And in terms of the doctors overusing care and so on, first of all, there's a lot of evidence that that's not the cause of the problems. That's what I'd argue. The papers, the scientific papers, that even that one of these scientific papers was saying is proof of it, says that that makes sense. And so for the last 40 years, because we know fee-for-service is so bad, we're spending all these new convoluted ways to make sure we have better payment systems, all of which start out by taking administrative costs. To me, I think the way you make sure people don't overprovide care is, first of all, the simpler your system, the better off you are. Our fee-for-service payment system is really screwed up. Some things they get paid way too much for, some things too little for, which, of course, makes them want to do it. I had a physician who said, you know, I give some kind of specialist in Mankato, Minnesota. I remember about 2 years ago talked to me, said, you know, I have a 45-minute consultation with a patient. I get, $150 or something. You know, if I sign off they need an MRI, I get another $150 of it. He says, that's really stupid. He says, you know, I hope I don't overdo that, but, you know, you got to admit that it may cross your mind that it doesn't hurt you to do that, and you get paid a lot for doing it. Why do we pay somebody if a doctor, if his genius, his skill, his talent is to consult with mental health or orthopedic care or whatever, if they are worth that, pay them the $150 an hour or $200 an hour or whatever they're worth. Don't pay them extra for referring you to blood tests that they shouldn't be doing, getting rid of the conflicts of interest, and the whole pricing system that we use from CMS and the whole coding system, which is getting more and more convoluted, is ripe for gaming. And so, yeah, I'm not saying we don't have to fix that. I'm saying we fix it by having a fair price negotiation system, which we don't have. So the current system is not a great one, but I'd argue that all the new payment reforms are making the system more convoluted. And with that, the quality-based payments, having a discussion earlier about whether that's a good thing or not, I have huge challenges to that for two reasons, one of which is, we'll cut it off right after this. One of which is that it punishes low-income clinics and low-income hospitals. It clearly has hurt them. The second one of which is that, you know, it's easy to game the system. People game the system, and it costs a fortune to administer these things. And does it improve quality, these quality-based payments? There was a study at the University of Michigan, and one of them said the same thing, that said the one of the payment reforms, the quality-based payment reforms, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is an early hospital readmission program. You kick somebody out of the hospital, if they have to go in within a month, you get penalized for doing that again. This study suggested that that had caused over 5,000 premature deaths from chronic heart failure in your patient in a year. 5,000 additional deaths from quality-related improvements. Stop. I made that case to our Department of Human Services. They didn't even respond. I'm very frustrated because I think a lot of those payment reforms are not saving money, and I'd say they are not improving quality. So I'm open to doing those, but it seems to me the one thing you want to have is a fair negotiation system in how you price things. And the other thing is the more you do the bundles of care and everything else, the more you have more consolidation. And the Affordable Care Act, Obama went to Grand Junction, Colorado, and a couple other places and said, they spend a third less than everybody else for health care. We want everybody to get good. They get just as good outcomes as everybody else. That paper I referred to earlier that talked about the knee replacement cost, that paper, the New York Times article, when it came out, was published at Yale. The headline of the New York Times, what the experts said about health care was wrong. I mean, it was saying that it's what the Affordable Care Act and all this has done by some of these payment reforms gets all these small providers to go into bigger and bigger networks. And the networks are now serving as insurance companies, too. So we've got two levels of insurance companies. Anyway, I'd be happy. That gets way into the weeds. I didn't mean to go that long on that. So I'll cut this off. I'll be around for a few more minutes to talk if anybody wants. And I'll be around the village if you want to talk later. Thank you.